Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.9, The Fedayi, Armenian Resistance, Part 4. Going into the 1890s, two parallel but deeply intertwined processes would begin to come to a head in eastern Anatolia. The first of these developments was the shifting imperial policies of Abdul Hamid, in which the Sultan began to throw his weight behind Kurdish tribal leaders as part of his effort to foster a new pan-Islamic Ottoman identity. Of course, Muslims had always enjoyed a superior position within the empire, but with the creation of the Sultan's personal cavalry, the Hamidiye regiments, which were made up mostly of Kurdish tribesmen and Kurdish bandits, Abdul Hamid's imperial policy increasingly began to take the side of Kurds and Turks, specifically at the expense of Armenians. Because the reality was that with the creation of the Hamidiye, armed Kurds and Turks in the regiments began to plunder and massacre Christian communities. But now that they were members of an official Ottoman cavalry, these murderous bandits would not be punished for their heinous acts. And so the second development, running parallel to and growing out of the Sultan's Islamization of the empire and his creation of the Hamidiye, was the increasing size and influence of Armenian revolutionary resistance to the Sultan's repressive policies in eastern Anatolia. These two processes would feed into each other as the Sultan and his government came to view every little thing that the Armenians did with an unreasonable level of suspicion. Whether it was town leaders asking the Ottomans to follow through on their promised reforms, or villages refusing to pay an exploitative tax to their despotic landlord, or a small Armenian guerrilla band attacking Kurdish bandits known for their especially harsh treatment of Armenians, all of these small, isolated acts of resistance came to be seen by Abdul Hamid as part of a widespread conspiratorial network backed by the great powers and meant to bring down his regime. And as the Sultan dealt out incredibly harsh punishments against Armenian communities for these pretty tiny infractions, more and more young Armenians began to join up with revolutionaries who were offering them weapons and training that they could use to defend their communities from this violent abuse. And so, what had begun as very small pockets of isolated resistance, a dozen guerrilla fighters here, a handful of revolutionaries over there, would coalesce into a broader and more well-organized resistance movement over the coming years, as a direct result of the Sultan's paranoid and murderous policies. And so were born the Fedayi, the soon-to-be legendary group of freedom fighters who would take up arms and resist the increasing violence being perpetrated against Ottoman Armenians. At first, the Fedayi were just a handful of volunteers, usually members of one of the Armenian revolutionary parties, the Hunchaks, the Arminikans, or the Dashnaks. And these early Fedayi would see the exploitation and violence around them and choose to leave their homes in order to help defend the defenseless peasants and townspeople of eastern Anatolia. The Fedayi would really enter onto the world stage in 1894, when a small skirmish broke out between a Kurdish tribe and an Armenian guerrilla band in the sub-province of Sassoon. As we will see, this skirmish, which had initially seemed like a pretty localized conflict, would end up bringing the growing tensions in eastern Anatolia to a dramatic and tragic climax. Sassoon was a very remote and mountainous region of southeastern Anatolia, where the local Armenian villagers and Kurdish nomads were largely cut off from the outside world, with many of the towns only accessible by treacherous footpaths. So, contact with the Ottoman imperial system typically only came in the form of administrators occasionally stopping by to collect the imperial tax from the Armenian and Kurdish peasants. And because the region was so cut off, the centralization efforts of the Tanzimat had only ever brought about surface-level changes. And for the most part, these areas were still controlled by the powerful Kurdish beys, who had long ruled the area as feudal landlords. The Tanzimat reforms were originally meant to reduce the power of these feudal landlords and to replace it with a better organized system of governing under imperial administrators. Now, this often had to do with rationalizing the tax system, the idea being that peasants would stop paying the Kurdish beys and start paying the central administration. But since these regions were so remote, the power of the Kurdish beys remained, though now in a more informal manner. But what this meant in practice is that the Armenians of Sassoon often had to pay double and even triple taxes. And because the arrangement with the Kurdish beys had now become informal, the Armenians were not even offered the protection services they used to receive in exchange for their taxes. So instead of paying a local Kurdish chieftain a tax, which would then obligate the bey to protect the tax-paying village, now local chieftains had no official obligation to do anything. And so the relationship increasingly became one of direct exploitation. A group of armed men stroll up and demand a tax, and then they leave, only to return when they want to collect the next tax. And this was often the rub with the Tanzimat reforms. Big promises, very little follow-through. Disrupt the old way of doing things without replacing it with anything. And this half-hearted assertion of imperial authority would often only serve to create a new sense of lawlessness and lead to an increasing resentment between populations, with Kurdish chieftains resenting Turkish officials and Armenian and Kurdish peasants resenting both the chieftains and the officials for overtaxing them. So, starting around 1889, Armenian villagers in Sassoon began to refuse to pay these double taxes. And though this put the village in a state of light rebellion for a few years, at this point no violence had yet erupted. But then, in 1891, an agent representing the Hunchak Revolutionary Party named Miran Damadian arrived in the area and offered up his services to the villagers of Sassoon. As we talked about last week, the arrival of agents from revolutionary parties like the Hunchaks, the Dashnaks, and the Armenikans to towns and villages across eastern Anatolia was becoming increasingly common. And this was mainly a product of necessity, in that law and order had begun to break down in these areas after the creation of the Hamidiye. So these towns and villages were oftentimes pretty eager to accept the limited protection such revolutionary agents could offer. So this Hunchak, Miran Damadian, was pretty typical of such revolutionaries, in that he was first and foremost a teacher. Damadian was originally from Constantinople and had received a college education in Venice, meaning that Damadian was one of those urban intellectuals of the Armenian diaspora. When Damadian graduated, he moved to eastern Anatolia and became an elementary school principal in the town of Mush, which is just north of Sassoon. And while working at this school, he was shocked by the poverty and deprivation of his fellow Armenians, and witnessing the sufferings of peasants and townspeople in eastern Anatolia radicalized him and led him to join up with the Hunchaks. After joining the party, Damadian took part in the Kumkapu demonstration of 1891 in Constantinople, which you may remember from last week was the real coming out party for the Hunchaks. After he and his fellow demonstrators were fired upon by Ottoman soldiers, Damadian was lucky enough to escape the ensuing riot unharmed. But like so many others at the demonstration, the experience at Kumkapu radicalized Damadian even further. And when he returned to eastern Anatolia, the young teacher resolved to travel into the mountains of Sassoon to begin his life as a fedayi, educating the downtrodden villagers, teaching them about revolutionary ideology, and most importantly, bringing the villagers weapons and showing them how to use these weapons to defend themselves against the Kurdish bandits and exploitative chieftains. After living with the villagers of Sassoon for about 6 months, Damadian was joined by another Hunchak agent who would be best known by his revolutionary pseudonym, his nom de guerre, Medzin Murad. Medzin Murad had originally joined the Hunchaks while he was living in Constantinople as a medical student. So like Demadian, Murad was an urban intellectual of the diaspora. And also like Demadian, Murad had taken part in the Kumkapu demonstration. This experience at Kumkapu of standing up to and then being fired upon by Ottoman imperial soldiers had radicalized Murad and inspired the 30-year-old doctor to fully dedicate himself to the revolutionary struggle in eastern Anatolia. So, in the summer of 1892, Murad would make his way to eastern Anatolia, and in order to avoid being captured by one of the many imperial spies who patrolled the borderlands, he would disguise himself as a Muslim sheikh named Medzen Murad. And this is when Murad would earn his revolutionary name, and when he symbolically would transform into a full-blown fedayi. When Murad joined Demadian in Sassoon, the local villagers would quickly embrace him because of his medical skills and because of his willingness to stand up to the exploitative chieftains and imperial administrators. That year, Murad and Demadian formed a small 7-man guerrilla force who would provide protection for the villagers of Sassoon against the exploitation of Kurdish bandits. Then, over the following year, the Hunchak guerrillas would engage in one small firefight against a local Kurdish tribe. And even though this was a pretty tiny engagement, this disturbance put Sassoon on the radar of the local imperial administrators. Now, these Ottoman officials would not immediately make a move against the Hunchak band, but they did begin to plan how they could most effectively crush these rebellious elements in the Sassoon Mountains. Then, in early 1893, Medzen Murad left Sassoon in order to gather money and supplies across the border in the Russian Caucasus. But while Murad was away, his comrade Demadian would be captured by the imperial police, leaving the villagers without their revolutionary leaders. Now, it is somewhat hard to pin down the exact causes and motivations for what happened next. But what is well established is that shortly after the arrest of Demadian, the local imperial governor began to actively organize bands of Kurds known for their especially harsh treatment of Armenians, and to encourage them to pass through Sassoon. And, well, the predictable result of this was that the bands of Kurds numbering in the thousands began to attack Armenian villages in Sassoon. And even though Demadian and Murad were both absent, the weapons and training that the Hunchaks had provided the villagers with proved indispensable as the local Armenians managed to retreat to a previously prepared mountain stronghold, where they were able to fend off the attacks of the much larger Kurdish force until the onset of winter, when the Kurds finally withdrew. But as the winter snows began to thaw in the spring of 1894, the Armenians knew that they would soon have to face what was sure to be harsh retribution from the Kurds, and possibly from local Ottoman officials as well. But during that winter, the Hunchak doctor, Murad, had finally returned to Sassoon, and he encouraged the villagers to hold strong. So when an Ottoman official, accompanied by several hundred imperial soldiers, came to collect the imperial tax, village elders declared that they would only pay it if they were exempted from having to pay the double tax to the local Kurdish chieftains. The Ottoman official reacted very poorly to this demand and began to verbally abuse the Armenian village elders. This led to a small brawl in which the Armenian villagers severely beat the Ottoman administrator and sent him on his way. Even though this little incident essentially amounted to no more than a fist fight, to the proud Ottoman administrator, this personal dishonor put the villagers of Sassoon in a state of active rebellion against the imperial government, and he reported to his superiors that a large military force would be needed to subdue the rebels. So, forces comprising both Ottoman imperial troops and Kurdish irregulars began to descend on the villagers of Sassoon. The Armenians once again fled into their mountain strongholds and began to hunker down. Then, during the ensuing standoff, Ottoman imperial representatives made contact with the villagers to demand once more the payment of their imperial tribute. But the villagers once more refused to pay unless they could be assured protection from the local Kurdish bandits. After a few such back and forths, the Kurdish irregulars conferred with the Imperial Army. And after this meeting, the Kurds were essentially given the green light by the Ottoman officers to attack the Armenians. And what followed was a dramatic battle in which the far outnumbered and outgunned Armenians were able to hold off the Kurds for nearly 2 weeks. And while the Ottoman army did not actively take part in this battle, they stood by and allowed events to unfold. Then, after 12 days of fighting, a Hamidiye regiment arrived on the scene, and this cavalry unit would turn the battle decisively in favor of the Kurds. So, the Armenians were finally dislodged from their mountain stronghold, and the villagers would chaotically disperse into the desolate landscape. The moment when the Armenians were scattered into the mountains was the moment when the Battle of Sassoon transformed from a heroic defense to a tragic massacre. Both Kurdish tribesmen and Ottoman soldiers began to indiscriminately kill any Armenians they could find, including women and children. And in the ensuing chaos, it is estimated that at least 1,000 to 3,000 now completely defenseless villagers were massacred. And the final brutal episode of this massacre occurred when an Armenian priest managed to make contact with an Ottoman officer. And this priest said that he would bring his villagers out of their hiding place in the mountains if they were left unharmed. The Ottoman officer assured the priest that no harm would be done to the villagers if they came out peacefully. Well, once the Armenians came down from the mountains, the Ottoman officer gave the order, the priest was seized, his eyes were gouged out by a throng of soldiers, and he was brutally stabbed to death in front of his helpless congregation. The soldiers then proceeded to massacre the villagers, including the elderly and the women and the children. The tragedy in Sassoon marked the beginning of what would later come to be called the Hamidian Massacres, because this incident would set off a chain of events that would end up sparking panic and fear amongst the population of eastern Anatolia, and really throughout the entire empire. And by the end of 1896, hundreds of thousands of Christian Armenians and Assyrians would be massacred in largely unprovoked killings perpetrated by Kurdish bandits, mobs of reactionary Muslims, Hamidiye cavalry regiments, and Ottoman imperial soldiers. Now, these massacres would not immediately erupt after Sassoon, and it would require a very specific sequence of events for this unprecedented level of violence to ultimately break out. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the unraveling would ultimately center upon Sultan Abdul Hamid and the great powers of Europe. Initially, all that really happened in the aftermath of the Sassoon massacre was that the Hunchak agent Murad was finally tracked down and arrested. But then British consuls and ambassadors stationed in eastern Anatolia began to get wind of the atrocities committed in Sassoon, and they quickly began to investigate the event. From the very start, Ottoman officials worked tirelessly to control the narrative surrounding the events in Sassoon, at first attempting to cover up the massacres, and then, when it became clear that word was getting out, they pivoted and tried to spin the story in such a way as to prevent a great power intervention into the area. This propaganda effort on the part of Abdul Hamid's government would begin a cycle of lies and half-truths that would come to dominate the official messaging of the Ottoman imperial government surrounding atrocities committed in eastern Anatolia for decades to come. The story almost always went that Armenian revolutionaries had been the first to act, initiating hostilities and intentionally bringing violent retribution down upon themselves in order to prompt a great power intervention. Then, it was maintained that violence was perpetrated solely by the quote-unquote wild and unruly Kurdish tribes, who seemingly could not contain their quote-unquote animal instincts. In this narrative, it was the two rebellious elements within the empire, the Armenians and the Kurds, who were to blame, with Ottoman officials playing the part of the rational arbiter trying their best to maintain law and order. But while Kurds would definitely commit horrific atrocities against Armenians, and while a small handful of Armenian revolutionaries had definitely been fostering a sense of proud rebelliousness amongst peasants and villagers, Ottoman administrators and imperial soldiers were absolutely complicit in the Sassoon massacre and would almost as a rule be complicit in the wider massacres that are to come. This is evidenced by the fact that in the areas of eastern Anatolia where Ottoman officials would step up and actively intervene to maintain law and order, massacres would not take place. Now, this is an important point for a couple of reasons. First off, it shows that Ottoman leaders out in the provinces did often have the ability to put an end to this violence. But instead, these local leaders decided to specifically encourage violence. And then second, and this is something that I think too often goes overlooked, it shows how there were many local leaders who did actively intervene to prevent arbitrary violence from breaking out in their communities. There were many Ottoman leaders who saw all of this for what it was, a terrible situation for everyone. And so many administrators and local leaders did everything they could to prevent the violence from spreading to their communities. So the Hamidian massacres were shockingly widespread. But the violence was the work of a very specific group of reactionaries, many of whom were literal bandits and criminals. And where massacres took place, these reactionaries were being encouraged by local authorities. From what I can tell, violence would break out when local imperial officials encouraged reactionaries and bandits and criminals to attack Armenians. So, the blame for the violence perpetrated against Christians between 1894 and 1896 can ultimately be traced up to the highest levels of government, up to Sultan Abdulhamid. For decades now, really ever since his first years as Sultan during the Congress of Berlin, Abdulhamid had come to view the Armenians as a major threat to the security of his empire. And according to one source, the Sultan is reported to have said in 1889, quote, "They can sever that head from my neck, but never Armenia from my empire. What is the Armenian question? One blow will suffice to stamp out the whole movement." And then when Abdulhamid was told that the villagers of Sassoon were allegedly in a state of rebellion, the Sultan had apparently entered into a state of panic and then given the orders to, quote, "stamp out the movement and destroy the villages." This message, coming directly from the Sultan, was then passed down, often reluctantly, through the chain of command, and these orders were the reason why the Hamidiye regiment was sent in to break the Armenians out of their mountain stronghold. And as we just saw, the arrival of the Hamidiye represented the moment when the standoff at Sassoon transitioned from being a light skirmish to being a horrific massacre. Whether these first-hand accounts of the Sultan's orders are to be fully believed or not, Abdulhamid clearly had blood on his hands, and he knew that he had to play things very carefully, so as not to prompt an intervention from the great powers that might lead to another partition of the empire or lead to his deposition. So what followed was a little game of diplomatic cat and mouse, in which the great powers, and really it was mostly the British, tried to get to the bottom of who was to blame for the Sassoon massacres, while Abdulhamid did everything he could to thwart their efforts. So, Abdulhamid hastily threw together a commission to investigate the Sassoon massacres in the spring of 1895. But ahead of this commission, orders were given to essentially clean up the crime scene, as houses were rebuilt, bodies were buried, and witnesses were paid off or told to skip town if you know what's good for you. But even with these efforts to cover things up, the members of the commission still uncovered gruesome details of the massacre. And most importantly, British journalists began to report many of these details back home. So it was the Bulgarian horrors all over again, so much so that the 87-year-old William Gladstone, who had originally coined the phrase Bulgarian horrors as the title of his 1876 book, would come out of retirement and dedicate the last speech of his career to denouncing Abdulhamid's bloody policies. And then Lord Salisbury, who had been the British diplomat present during the Constantinople Conference amidst the Great Eastern Crisis 20 years earlier, was now prime minister. And Lord Salisbury put immense pressure on Sultan Abdul Hamid to announce reforms in response to the Sassoon Massacre. So, really having no other choice here, Abdul Hamid would, after characteristically dragging his feet for a few months, finally announce a reform package in the fall of 1895. But as usual, these reforms would bring about no real material change to Eastern Anatolia. And the primary concession within the reform plan was that Muslim governors would have to employ Christian assistants, which, okay, seems like a good start, but these Christian assistants had zero connection to the local population. So, in reality, they were just yet more out-of-touch imperial bureaucrats who would basically just sign off on whatever their superiors asked them to sign off on. So, the reforms promulgated by Abdul Hamid were clearly just a bald-faced attempt to get the great powers off his back. The Sassoon Massacre and the transparently flimsy response on the part of the imperial government would have a galvanizing effect on the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire. For many years, the strongest element within Armenian politics had been conservative, as influential and powerful Armenians living in cities like Constantinople were not only cut off from the harsh realities of Eastern Anatolia, but were also keenly aware of the impossibility of establishing an independent or even autonomous Armenia within a region that was majority Muslim. So, the most powerful Armenians in government had always pushed for pretty conservative reforms, strengthening the national church, building schools, and promoting economic development. But after Sassoon, even many conservative Armenians began to think, what good was reform if the empire's leaders were now essentially trying to beat their community into submission, or possibly into extinction? In short, Sassoon was a radicalizing event for Armenians across the Ottoman Empire. On September 30, 1895, the Hunchak Revolutionary Party led a very large demonstration in Constantinople, in which thousands of people protested outside the imperial government's central administration at the Sublime Porte. The Hunchaks had alerted the government of this planned demonstration 2 days before it happened, and they had assured officials that it was going to be peaceful. However, during the planning, the Hunchaks had been split on whether or not the demonstrators should be armed, seeing as they had been fired upon by soldiers during the Kumkapu demonstration in 1890. This debate within the Hunchak party was never really resolved, so many demonstrators would show up to the protest with pistols, rifles, and knives. On the day of the demonstration, some 2,000 people gathered outside the Armenian Patriarchate and prepared to march to the Sublime Porte to present their list of demands to the government. These demands were fairly simple: put an end to the unprovoked violence perpetrated against Armenian civilians, put an end to the exploitative tax system, put an end to arbitrary arrests, and ensure the long-term safety of people and property in the 6 Armenian provinces. And finally, the demonstrators demanded freedom of consciousness, freedom of the press, and the right to peacefully assemble, demonstrate, and protest. While this crowd was gathering outside of the Patriarchate, there was a brief moment when prominent Armenian leaders tried to ease tensions, hoping to find an alternative solution that might prevent this huge, angry crowd from marching through the streets of Constantinople. But then, during these discussions, a protester allegedly yelled, "Freedom or death," and the demonstrators began to chant this revolutionary slogan as they began their treacherous march towards the Sublime Porte. When the demonstrators reached the Sublime Porte, they were halted by a large cavalry who had been stationed there to prevent anyone from entering government buildings. Then, an imperial officer gave the order for the troops to push the crowd back with the butt end of their guns. But an Armenian student refused to budge, and asked the officer what authority gave them the right to bar the way of peaceful Ottoman subjects simply wishing to present a petition to the government. The flustered and dishonored officer then apparently yelled, "Damn infidel," and struck the young man with his sword. To defend himself, the Armenian student quickly drew out a pistol and shot the Ottoman officer in the head, killing him instantly. After this, all hell broke loose. The soldiers descended upon the crowd and began beating the demonstrators, some of them to death. The majority of the crowd began to chaotically disperse. But then, as the Armenians were retreating, a group of reactionary Muslim students, who had very mysteriously been waiting for this retreat and were already armed with clubs, pounced on the Armenian demonstrators and began indiscriminately pummeling people. And over the next several days, this riot would set off a much larger anti-Christian pogrom across Constantinople. Throughout the Armenian quarters of the capital, mobs of reactionary thugs and fanatical religious students began indiscriminately massacring defenseless civilians, as the police and military simply stood by and even at times actively participated in the killings. After nearly 10 days of violence, great power diplomats who had been pressing the government to put an end to the madness for over a week now were finally able to arrange an end to the atrocities. But as things began to calm down in the imperial capital, news came in that the killings in Constantinople were not isolated incidents, and that widespread anti-Armenian massacres were ongoing in towns and cities across the empire, especially in eastern Anatolia. These massacres had spread like wildfire as horrific scenes of mass violence were repeated in town after town, in Trebizond, in Akhazar, in Arzanjan, in Bitlis, in Urfa, in Erzurum, in Diyarbakir, in Sivas, in Kharput, and on and on and on. Broadly speaking, the dominant emotion throughout these massacres was one of panic and fear. A local official would be shot by an unknown assailant. Muslim leaders would blame Armenian revolutionaries, almost always without proof. Armenian townsfolk would close their shops, fearing repressive measures. Ottoman officials would raid the Armenian quarter in search of alleged criminals, subjecting the locals to arbitrary abuse. Armenians would fight back and defend themselves. Ottoman officials would claim that the Armenians were in revolt, stoking fears amongst local Muslims that revolutionaries planned to take the town in order to hand it over to the great powers or to establish a fantastical Kingdom of Armenia. The officials would then give the go-ahead to imperial soldiers, Kurdish bandits, Hamidiye regiments, and/or reactionary mobs to attack Armenian neighborhoods in retribution for their acts of self-defense, which the authorities always interpreted as revolts. Scenes such as this, each with their own little intricacies, repeated themselves in town after town, in village after village. And when all was said and done, the devastation was truly mind-boggling. Conservative estimates put the number of dead at just under 100,000, with some historians putting the number as high as 300,000 human beings. Then, on top of this inconceivable loss of life, at least 500,000 Armenians and Assyrians were left homeless as thousands of villages were burned and looted, and hundreds of churches were desecrated or forcibly converted into mosques. Trying to ascribe meaning to such meaningless violence is ultimately an impossible task. But what we can say is that paranoia and fear at having the empire dismembered and having territories annexed by the great powers or turned into an independent Christian nation state as a result of Armenian revolutionary activity had rippled across the empire and had created an impassable gulf between the Muslim and Christian communities of eastern Anatolia. For centuries, Armenians had been viewed by Muslim elites as the loyal millet, But then, in the years following the Congress of Berlin, the conspiratorial paranoia of Sultan Abdul Hamid and his fellow statesmen had infected the populace and led reactionary Muslims to increasingly view the Armenians as a dangerous, rebellious, and alien element within the empire. And so, these reactionary thugs, following the example of their sultan, came to believe that they needed to punish Armenians for their perceived rebelliousness, to put the Armenians back in their place, if you will. But another side to all of this was the acute scarcity and harshness of life in eastern Anatolia. Because in the wake of the massacres, thousands of Muslims would occupy lands previously owned by Armenians who had either been killed or displaced. And in this sense, the Hamidian massacres were simply the extreme violent culmination of a process that had been ongoing for decades now, as Muslims who had themselves been driven out of their homes in the Caucasus and the Balkans due to the persecution at the hands of the Russian imperial government gradually displaced Christians in Ottoman Eastern Anatolia. And then finally, there were the great powers. Because these massacres in eastern Anatolia, in a lot of ways, happened in direct reaction to those reforms that the great powers had forced upon Abdul Hamid after the Sassoon massacres. Because even though these reforms were ultimately toothless and brought about almost no real change for the Armenians, they were viewed by many Muslims as the first step towards annexation into the Russian Empire or to the creation of an independent Armenia. Both of these outcomes had been directly experienced by many people living in eastern Anatolia. And so in this sense, their extreme level of fear and paranoia can be understood. But the point is that Abdul Hamid and his administrators did nothing to quell these fears. And more often than not, they intentionally stoked them, knowing what the consequences would be. Even though the vast majority of the victims during the Hamidian massacres were defenseless civilians, many Armenian revolutionaries and fedayi had done everything they possibly could to defend their communities from this horrific arbitrary violence. And in at least a couple instances, this resistance on the part of the fedayi would save the lives of thousands of innocent townspeople, with the most dramatic examples of such resistance occurring in the towns of Zeytun and Van. Nestled high in the Taurus Mountains of Cilicia, and sitting just inland of the southeastern Anatolian coast, lies the town of Zeytun. With buildings and high walls constructed into the rock face and only accessible through narrow paths twisting along steep ravines, Zeytun functioned like one giant fortress capable of holding off the most formidable invaders. Guarded by this natural defense and further defended by a population of fiercely independent mountaineers, Zeytun had long acted as a symbol of resistance and perseverance for the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire. During the original Ottoman conquests, Zeytun had been able to resist being conquered and would essentially act as a tiny independent city-state within a sea of Ottoman lands. And in 1618, Sultan Murad IV decided that it was hopeless trying to get these crazy mountain people to submit, and so Zeytun was granted official autonomy in exchange for a yearly imperial tribute. So, long before the Serbs or the Greeks would rise up, the Armenians of Zeytun had been holding off the Ottomans for centuries, and through their determined resistance, they ensured their continued right to self-governance and their right to bear arms, rights denied to other Christians. Then, in 1862, Tanzimat reformers, hoping to rein in the rebellious elements of the empire, would send in a force of over 10,000 troops to try and once and for all bring the Armenians of Zeytun into the Ottoman fold. However, the mountaineers of Zeytun would fend off this Ottoman invasion just like they had fended off all the other Ottoman invasions for the past several centuries. And beginning what would become a bit of a trend, a very small group of just a few thousand Armenian fighters were able to hold off the Ottoman force, which numbered in the tens of thousands. So, Zeytun would maintain its autonomous status after this 1862 victory against the Ottomans. In the years following the 1862 Zaytun resistance, the imperial government would continue to harass the Armenians living there, sending in troops who would creepily lurk around the town and occasionally cause trouble. But as Armenian nationalism was growing as an ideological movement, Zaytun became a major symbol of resistance to Ottoman oppression. And starting in the 1890s, representatives from the Hunchak Revolutionary Party began showing up in Zaytun and offering up their services as revolutionary teachers and fighters, and providing the locals with weapons to help defend their community. Then, in the fall of 1895, the Armenians of Zaytun began to get wind of the horrific massacres being perpetrated in the towns and cities to the north, and they began to notice an increasing number of Ottoman troops and imperial agents in their area. So, the mountaineers and revolutionaries of the town decided that they needed to take preemptive action, and they began to launch guerrilla attacks against nearby Ottoman garrisons. Through such attacks, the Zaytunzis, as they were known, essentially gained control of the entire district surrounding the town. In response, the Ottomans organized a pretty huge invasion force to put down the rebels, with close to 30,000 imperial troops and another 30,000 Kurdish and Circassian irregulars. The Zaytunzi force was much smaller and much less organized, with just a few thousand fighters split up into little guerrilla bands and revolutionary units. Nevertheless, the Armenians held off the Ottomans for weeks until the Armenians were finally driven back by late December into the mountain stronghold of Zaytun itself. But as the siege of Zaytun was ongoing, atrocities and counter-atrocities were being committed all around the town, as Ottoman troops and Muslim irregulars killed Christians in the towns they retook, and Armenian bands initiated revenge killings in response. So, with chaos engulfing the region, the great powers intervened in the Zaytun conflict as part of their larger ongoing intervention to put a stop to the Hamidian massacres. In January of 1896, it was finally agreed that all civilians in the area, both Christian and Muslim, would have to surrender their weapons. Then, Zaytun's tax burden would be eased, a Christian sub-governor would be appointed, and a general amnesty was declared in which the Hunchak revolutionaries were allowed safe passage out of Ottoman lands. And over the next several decades, Zaytun would carry on as a little semi-autonomous Armenian town, as the Zaytunzis had once again held off the mighty Ottomans. The other site of major resistance amidst the Hamidian massacres would occur in the city of Van, which had long been the heart of Armenian life in eastern Anatolia, and the birthplace of the first Armenian political party and home of the now legendary Father Crimean. And in Van, Armenian fedayi from all three revolutionary groups, the Hunchaks, the Dashnaks, and the Armenikans, would come together and put up a heroic defense of the city. Van had avoided the original massacres that had occurred in the fall of 1895 and spring of 1896. But then in June of 1896, Ottoman officials organized an expedition to be sent to Van to attack the large Armenian population living there and to force them to submit to the Sultan's will. The Armenian revolutionary parties had known that this attack was coming for some time, so they prepared a defense of the city and put together a fighting force of some 600 to 700 fedayi. These freedom fighters hunkered down in the city's garden district and successfully held off the far superior force sent in by the Ottomans for over a week. But because great power attention was at this point fully fixed on Abdul Hamid, the Sultan would himself request that great power delegates help to broker a peace between the fedayi of Van and the Ottomans. So, with European diplomats acting as mediators, the revolutionary fighters agreed to end their defense of the city in exchange for safe passage to Persia. But while the fedayi had successfully saved Van from suffering the same terrible fate of so many other towns throughout eastern Anatolia, the fedayi themselves would not be so lucky, as the treachery of Ottoman officials was laid bare one last time. During their march towards the Persian border, the 1,000 or so Armenians being transported were suddenly attacked by a contingent of Kurdish bandits and Ottoman soldiers, who proceeded to massacre them before they could reach the safety of Persian lands. A small group of Fedayi would escape this treacherous attack, though, and make it across the border. And then a year later, these same Fedayi, under the leadership of the Dashnak founder, Christopher Michalian, would launch a punitive raid called the Khanasur Expedition against the Kurdish tribe, primarily responsible for the massacres outside Van. And this expedition would be headed off by a 31-year-old former carpenter named Andranik, who would, in the years following the Hamidian massacres, continue the Armenian resistance, as he would rebuild the Fedayi and slowly remake them into a force that would eventually become even stronger than it had been in the years before the massacres. Andranik, who Leon Trotsky once described as a hero of song and legend, will continue to be a recurring character in our narrative, as he will persistently fight for the Armenian cause going into the 1900s, through the Balkan Wars, and on into World War I. In the coming years, Andranik will carry on the torch of the Fedayi, leading these determined freedom fighters, whose numbers would always be quite small, but who nonetheless would continue to stand up to arbitrary violence and abuse, even when the odds were so heavily stacked against them. But the Armenian resistance amidst the Hamidian massacres would have one last dramatic episode to bookend this tragic tale. Because in August of 1896, a group of revolutionary Dashnaks would decide that the only way to prompt the great powers to intervene on behalf of the defenseless Armenians and to save their people from possible extinction was to pull off a stunt so spectacular that the world would have to pay attention. And so, the 24-year-old Armen Garo, who would later go on to help form the First Armenian Republic, would make his debut onto the world stage as he and his comrades somehow managed to pull off the Ottoman bank takeover.